Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Monday, July 28th. I'm Jordan Pangelinan, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office provides an update on the Glendale officer-involved shooting over the weekend. The Orleans Complex fire reaches over 21,000 acres over the weekend, but increases its containment to 38%. And the Mendocino Land Trust announces a 157-acre coastal blufftop land acquisition for Bell Point. So stay tuned. News on those stories and more coming right up. Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkiyon, Wailaki, Wiyot, Wilcut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection these tribes have to this region. The Humboldt County Sheriff's Office has issued a press release today with an update on the officer-involved shooting that took place on July 26, 2025, in the Glendale community. KMUD News reached out for a comment, but did not receive a response by news time. On July 26, 2025, at approximately 8 p.m., Humboldt County Sheriff's deputies responded to the 1300 block of Glendale Avenue near Blue Lake to serve an arrest warrant on a suspect wanted for felon in possession of a firearm. The suspect was also wanted in connection with a brandishing of a firearm incident that had occurred earlier in the day. While deputies were staging in a private parking lot near the location, they observed the suspect walk into the roadway in front of them. Deputies pursued the suspect on foot eastbound, where he fled into nearby bushes on the north side of the street. Deputies surrounded the suspect and gave commands for him to surrender. At the time, an officer-involved shooting occurred. Multiple deputies discharged their service weapons at the suspect following a brief standoff. Deputies approached, secured the suspect and his firearm, and immediately began rendering life-saving aid. Emergency medical personnel arrived on scene and continued life-saving efforts. The suspect was transported by ambulance to a local hospital, where he was pronounced deceased. The deceased has been identified as Jared Randall Nelson, 35, of Eureka, California. Following a foot pursuit, Mr. Nelson discharged a .45 caliber handgun at pursuing deputies. The firearm was recovered at the scene in accordance with the standard protocol. Three Humboldt County Sheriff's Office deputies involved in the incident have been placed on paid administrative leave pending the outcome of the investigation. This remains an active investigation, and further details will be released as appropriate. The Humboldt County Sheriff's Office encourages anyone with information regarding the incident to contact the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office at 707-445-7251. KMUD News will continue to report as we get more information. A provided update on the Orleans Complex per news release from the Klamath National Forest Facebook page outlining the current status of both fires, today's activities, and plans moving forward. The Orleans Complex currently stands at 21,070 acres with a 38% containment, and current personnel on scene stands at 1,880. Today, crews remain on high alert for new starts and increased fire activity due to predicted drier conditions and thunderstorms over the fire area today. Firefighters will be scouting containment options west of Lunch Creek while continuing suppression actions towards Nordheimer, the wilderness boundary, and previously burned Red Salmon fire area. In the east, crews will continue to brush roads to open access on 39 and 39 North 30, roads east of Cecilville Road near Godfrey Ranch. A slight warming trend begins today with temperatures climbing the daily maximum a few degrees each day, beginning at an expected 90 to 93 degrees. Very low relative humidities will cause substantial drying and create a high probability of ignition of new starts. Similar winds are expected in the valleys upslope to 3 to 5 miles an hour, up valley of 5 to 10 miles an hour, out of the northwest with potential gusting up to 18 miles an hour. The predicted path of storms now cover the Butler Fire area as well as the Edna Base Camp beginning early in the afternoon. These predicted storms could bring lightning and erratic winds, causing fire behaviors to increase. There are current evacuation orders and warnings in the immediate vicinity of the fire. For your evacuation status, the Siskiyou County Sheriff's Facebook and the Siskiyou Office of Emergency Services Facebook has additional information. Evacuation information and maps can be found at protectgenesis.com, that's protect.genasys.com. An official forest closure around the Orleans Complex went into effect on July 16th. Hikers are not permitted and will be asked to leave the area. Forest fire restrictions are also currently in effect. Please visit the local forest pages for more information. The Klamath National Forest website is https://www.fs.usda.gov/r05/. KMUD will continue with updates as they come. Mendocino Land Trust announced that it has finalized the purchase of the 157-acre coastal blufftop property known as Bell Point, located just south of Westport on the northern Mendocino coast. Bell Point sits by the southern edge of the village of Westport. It consists of approximately 50 acres of open coastal headlands, coastal meadows, riparian wetland, and a Bishop pine forest. Across Highway 1, an additional 100 acres of mixed redwood forest, meadowland, and ocean view ridgelines will also be preserved. The headlands offers a 180-degree view of the rocky Mendocino coastline. The Mendocino Land Trust now moves into the planning of the project, designing and building a new portion of the California Coastal Trail, a projected parking area, and ultimately returning the property to Kaipoma, a nonprofit representing three local Native American tribes who will also soon own nearby Blues Beach to the south. Bell Point Project Lead, MLT Director of Land Protection, Emily Griffin, spoke to KMUD News in an interview about what to expect from the project and how it similarly to other conservation projects are working closely with local Native tribes.
The acquisition of Bell Point is really exciting for us. It's a large coastal property, 157 acres, so this will be our second largest preserve that we own in the county, and it will, once we open it for public access, it'll actually be the largest publicly accessible preserve that we own. We do own a 400-acre redwood forest, but it's pretty inaccessible a few miles west of Willits on the Skunk Train tracks. So we're very excited to own another coastal property. We have several properties up and down the Mendocino coast, from Pelican Bluffs down south of Point Arena to Navarro Point near Albion and a couple of beaches near Fort Bragg. But this is a beautiful blufftop property. It's very close to the village of Westport, so it really increases the opportunity for public recreation in and near Westport. And we're particularly excited that this property, we will not own it forever. We'll be transferring it to a group of three local tribes. So it's our first land return project where we're actually acquiring a property in order to transfer that property for long-term management and stewardship by local tribes.
In December of 2024, MLT announced that it was under a contract to purchase a 157-acre coastal blufftop property. The acquisition was made possible by a $2.5 million grant from the State Coastal Conservancy.
This property was actually on the market for quite a while before we even made an offer on it. And, you know, it's really difficult for a land trust to acquire publicly listed properties because we don't have the money in our pockets to go make offers and purchase them. We aren't like a traditional private buyer who can get a mortgage. That's not how it works. We have to find grant funding. So, you know, the first trick is finding a seller willing to enter into a purchase transaction with us that allows us the time to go collect the grant funding and apply for grant funding and actually receive a grant agreement and then actually receive the grant funds. And you never know how long that's going to take. But in this case, we worked really closely with the California State Coastal Conservancy, which is, you know, it's really focused on protecting the coast and increasing public access on the coast. And they were wonderful. And we actually got the whole process done in less than a year, in about 10 months, once we entered into the purchase agreement with the seller. But it was a lot of back and forth with the seller to reach an agreement on a price and on all of those terms of the long escrow period and the contingencies built in for obtaining the grant funding. But once we got that lined up, it went more or less pretty smoothly at that point. At that point, it's mostly, fulfilling all of the obligations of the grant agreement in order to get it funded and be able to purchase the property.
Additionally, the California Council of Land Trusts awarded MLT a $95,000 project advancement grant to support the initiative. The project included the plans to develop a new segment of the California Coastal Trail and return the land to Kaipoma, the nonprofit organization representing the local Native tribes.
Yes. Currently some of our biggest focuses are on increasing public access throughout the county. This certainly fills that bill on working with the Coastal Conservancy to increase the public access to the coast in particular and development of what they call the California Coastal Trail. Part of the Coastal Conservancy's goal is to have public access trails all the way up and down the coast, along the bluff top as much as possible or west of Highway 1. Wherever that's possible. So those are big things that we're focusing on, and this really fills those goals. And then working closely with tribes to return land that was their ancestral lands and, rematriating that land to them and letting them decide what the future of that land will be and stewarding it in the future is also a big part of our goals and priorities right now. So being able to do that here is really exciting.
MLT's mission with these projects is to protect high conservation value lands, ensure public access where appropriate, and in this case, support the return of property to Kaipoma. As MLT's Griffin put it, these lands will remain natural from here on out, underscoring the commitment to permanent preservation of cultural restoration.
Then there's an additional 100 acres on the east side of the highway as well, which is mostly forested. And, part of when we acquire properties like this with grant funding, part of the agreement is we are not going to further develop them. So it won't be commercially harvested for timber. And there is a decent amount of redwood timber on it, and it won't be developed, with homes or anything else. So that whole hillside, that whole ridge line on the east side of Highway 1, those views will always be natural from now on, for about a mile of Highway 1.
Now that MLT officially owns the land, Griffin explained to KMUD that they will begin implementing the plans laid out from the start, outlining how they intend to move forward and the next phases of the project.
Yeah, what we're hoping to do, and it all depends on the planning process, which is what we're turning to now that we actually own it, and there are a lot of constraints as far as, where there might be special, unique plants or trees or wetlands that we need to protect, or also cultural and archaeological resources. Graveyards or archaeological sites from tribal historical use of the property. So we do a lot of surveys and reports to figure out where all of those special items are that we might need to protect. And then we design and build the public trail system on the property based on protecting those things first and foremost. So our goal is to provide a small parking lot and then trails to go out and around the point and along the bluff top. And our longer-term goal would be to connect it to the village of Westport itself, if we can, so that people who are either camping or staying in the village of Westport or live in Westport can walk directly to Bell Point without having to get in their car and, drive. There is some private property in between the property and Westport, so it would mean getting additional public access easements across that property as well. So that's sort of a longer-term goal as well, is to make it even better for the people in Westport to be able to go on nice long walks along the ocean.
As previously mentioned, MLT plans to transfer ownership of the property to Kaipoma. MLT's long-term objective is to better understand the land and support the needs identified by its future stewards. According to Griffin, once the public trails are completed, decisions about the management and use of remaining land will be determined by Kaipoma.
Yeah, now that we own it, our plan is to work, start working with them more, significantly and intensely to start to plan for what the long-term management of the property will be. So part of that is a resource management plan where we, figure out sort of what the best way to manage the property is long-term, usually with some experts and consultants in that area of resource management. And then just more general management planning of, what does Kaipoma envision for this property? What do they want to do with it? How do they want to use it? There is an old barn on the property. Is there some future use for that barn? Those sorts of things. So long-term, Mendocino Land Trust will continue to maintain and steward the public trails. Once we build them, we'll take care of them and keep them open to the public. And we'll hold a public access easement on the property to enable us to do that. But the rest of the property will all be owned and managed by Kaipoma. So we have some grant funding for them to use to do their own long-term planning for the project. We don't want to, tell them what they need to do with it. We want them to start, working on what they see for the property and what they would like to do with it.
Although not required to transfer the land, Griffin explained the decision to return it to Kaipooma reflects a broader commitment to both environmental restoration and recognizing the cultural significance to the area of local tribes. They also emphasized the value of working with those who have a deep knowledge of the land to guide its future stewardship.
So I'm sure you know, all of the Mendocino Coast was once tribal indigenous land, and most of those indigenous people were essentially forcibly removed from their land and driven, often east to Round Valley or those sorts of things. So, we are on land that was originally theirs, and to be able to just in a very small way help to, do some reparation of that historical loss and that historical tragedy, and to work with the tribal members who are here today to have access to those lands, and use them in the way they see fit and steward them. To do that is just a wonderful thing that we're excited to be able to do. We're happy to be able to work with Kaipooma on that and collaborate with them as partners. We're looking forward to seeing what happens with them in the future.
The Bell Point Project marks a new chapter in the land conservation along the northern Mendocino coast. With the purchase now complete, the Mendocino Land Trust begins the next phase, planning public access improvements like trails and parking, while coordinating the eventual transfer of the land to Kaipooma. As the project moves forward, KMUD will continue with updates. For more information on the Mendocino Land Trust projects, the website is mendocinolandtrust.org. In state news, San Francisco is to pay $3 million for changes in policies after lawsuit over homeless encampment sweeps, KPFA's Dahlia Lozier reports.
San Francisco has agreed to make changes to how it clears homeless encampments following a lawsuit that accused the city of illegally destroying unhoused people's belongings. The lawsuit was filed in 2022 by the Coalition on Homelessness and several unhoused plaintiffs. It alleged that San Francisco's Public Works Department workers had failed to follow the city's own rules, including the bag and tag policy, which prohibits the throwing away of unhoused people's belongings. Nisha Kashyap of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights of the San Francisco Bay Area is one of the lawyers representing the plaintiffs. She says the lawsuit was not about a failure of policy. It was about a failure of practice.
What this case was about was the gap between what the city said it was doing and what our clients alleged it was actually doing. And this settlement has important, robust monitoring and oversight components that allow our clients to ensure that the city going forward will actually do what it says it will do. And if the city If there are violations that are documented, then there's a process to go to court to raise those violations.
The lawsuit, Coalition on Homelessness versus the City and County of San Francisco, originally alleged that the city had violated people's Eighth Amendment rights, specifically the clause prohibiting cruel or unusual punishment, by threatening to arrest or cite them for sleeping on the streets, despite a lack of available shelter. That component of the lawsuit became moot in June 2024 when the Supreme Court overruled lower court rulings that had said that similar measures violate the Constitution. But Kashyap says that other rights remain in place.
In this case, there were two key rights that were at issue. The Fourth Amendment right against property destruction, wrongful property destruction, and our 14th Amendment right to notice and process if the government is going to take our property.
As part of the settlement, the city agreed to policy changes, including new training requirements for public works employees and increased documentation of all homelessness operations. The Coalition on Homelessness will be allowed to review city records related to homeless sweeps, as well as visit the public works storage yard where belongings collected during cleanups are kept. If the Coalition documents 10 or more cases within a 90-day period where the city improperly takes or destroys unhoused people's property, they can initiate a formal dispute and have a judge mediate the issue. Kashyap explained the real-world impact plaintiffs are hoping this oversight will have.
This settlement allows the Coalition on Homelessness to monitor what is happening on the ground in real people's lives And if in the future there are documented violations of the city's policies as it relates to the handling of unhoused people, the settlement also provides for court oversight as necessary to address those violations.
City Attorney spokesperson Jen Quart said in a written statement that the city was pleased to put the lawsuit behind them. She went on to write that, quote, this settlement should not be interpreted as an admission of liability or wrongdoing on San Francisco's part, end quote. The city will end up paying $2.8 million as part of the settlement, though the vast majority of this money will go towards attorney's fees for the plaintiffs. Kashyap says money is not the important part of the settlement.
The accountability measures in the settlement are not derived from the monetary amount, but rather the provisions in the settlement that provide for ongoing enforcement and oversight of the city's practices as it relates to the handling of unhoused people's properties.
Any settlement with the city of San Francisco must be approved by the Board of Supervisors and the mayor. Kashyap says that plaintiffs are looking forward to the board's approval. For KPFA News, I'm Dahlia Lozier.
In national news, World Court rules countries that don't act on climate crisis may be liable for violating human rights laws. KPFA's Christina Anastad reports.
Calling climate change an existential threat that imperils all forms of life and the very health of the planet, the world's highest court ruled countries could be liable for failing to take action to protect the planet from climate change and in violation of international law. International Court of Justice President Judge Iwasawa Yuji read the 500-page ruling.
The court concludes that the duty of states to prevent significant environmental harm applies in the context of climate change, and that this duty forms part of the most directly relevant applicable law.
The case was filed by Vanuatu and supported by 130 nations, including other Pacific low-lying islands. Outside The Hague, climate justice advocates celebrated the ruling. Julian Agun is an indigenous human rights lawyer and writer from Guam.
The sea is rising and the water is getting warm. The inundated need no instruction in inundation. We have eyes of our own, and besides, we are busy scraping barnacles off our grandfathers' graves and others' headstones drowned at high tide. We know how critical it is our coral reefs stay healthy and our mangrove forests dense. We will defend them to the end.
The landmark ruling also says a clean, healthy, and sustainable environment is a human right. It's a non-binding ruling, so it has no teeth, but it is guidance to nation states on how to proceed with legal challenges against major greenhouse gas polluters like the United States and China. The ruling could lead to international cases of states taking other states to court before the ICJ. Domestic lawsuits, along with legally binding agreements, like loss and mitigation plans. The ruling also says major greenhouse gas emitters can be liable for paying reparations to smaller nations that are most impacted by climate change, like Vanuatu. Judge Yuji says while it may be difficult to ascertain the burden of each state's damage, liability can be claimed on a case-by-case basis.
The fact that the damage was the result of concurrent causes is not sufficient to exempt a state from any obligation to make reparation.
All UN member states, including major greenhouse gas emitters like the United States and China, are parties to the court. Outside, climate activists gathered with a banner that read, "Courts have spoken. The law is clear. States must act now."
What do we want?
Climate justice!
Nicole Ann Ponce is an environmental and human rights lawyer from the Philippines.
We've been told again and again that what we're fighting for is too ambitious, but that's exactly the point. Ambition should be the benchmark, exactly because only bold, ambitious action can address the urgency of the climate crisis. This moment shows that the youth and global South communities have the power to shape international law and seek reparations for damages done.
I'm Christina Onnestad, reporting for Pacifica Radio, KPFA.
In National Native News, Antonia Gonzalez reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Mescalero Apache leaders recently told New Mexico state lawmakers they're concerned about possible federal funding cuts to law enforcement. Jeanette Didios has more.
The Economic and Rural Development and Policy Committee held its interim hearing in Mescalero, New Mexico. Vice President of the Mescalero Apache Tribe, Dwayne Duffy, estimates that there could be a 20 to 30% decrease in federal funding for law enforcement based on the proposed budget from the White House. He says this is concerning because the tribe relies completely on federal funding to pay for its law enforcement.
The federal government just built a brand new detention facility on our reservation, and they're still trying to staff that. And, you know, the question is, are those federal cuts, are they going to affect whether or not they're going to be able to open that facility? And so they'll have a federal facility sitting there as a shell vacant until they can fully staff it.
The tribal nation makes up 463,000 acres, and it relies on six Bureau of Indian Affairs law enforcement officers. President of the Mescalero Apache tribe, Thora Padilla, says even losing one officer could be detrimental.
So any kind of cut's going to really impact us. And it's difficult to try to stretch those resources over the 24-hour period that we have to protect our people with.
Duffy says he and Padilla will be having further discussions with both the federal and state delegations to work on filling the gaps from future cuts. I'm Jeanette Didios.
The Trump administration wants to eliminate the federal agency that's helped Alaska villages develop infrastructure with more than $2 billion over the decades. Ayulna Naidin with the Alaska Desk reports on how likely the government is to cut the Denali Commission and who would stand to lose.
The cut is in a Trump administration's budget proposal for the federal fiscal year that begins in October. It is an effort to curtail what they call taxpayer waste and reduce the federal role in local economic development. Julie Kitka is the federal co-chair at the Denali Commission. She says previous administrations have made similar proposals, and she's optimistic about the commission continuing its work.
We take it seriously, but we're very hopeful that we'll be identified and funded in the appropriations process.
The president's skinny budget outlines the administration's funding priorities, but Congress has the final say, expected in legislation in September or later. Congress created the Denali Commission in 1998 to work in partnership with the federal government, state, and tribes to address rural Alaska's needs. Since then, the agency has been helping villages develop power generation facilities, transportation infrastructure, and water and sewer systems. It has also provided job training and funded over 150 rural health clinics.
We have priority on small and distressed communities environmentally threatened.
The administration said it wants to cut the Denali Commission because states understand their local issues best and can address them more effectively. The state of Alaska is already a partner and a co-chair on the Denali Commission. Overall, Kitka says Alaska is growing in national and international importance, and she believes the administration will recognize the infrastructure needs in a state in such a strategic location.
There is really important work that needs to be done in our state for the resilience of our communities and our people to deal with the challenges that are just growing. Warming of the Arctic and the increased transit, the access for natural resources, trade.
Kitka says she will continue working with the House and Senate to make the case for the commission. I am Alona Naidin.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Javier Rodriguez, and thanks to our reporters, Dahlia Lozier, Christina Anastad, and Antonia Gonzalez. KMUD News is online, and you can find us on kmud.org, and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@knud.org. Redwood Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Jordan Pangelinan.